Let's start again. Okay, so I'd like to use this talk to both introduce you to our recent results on SAGE Star with EHT, but also to give you an overview of polarimetry with the EHT in general, the types of observables that we'll be sensitive to, and the measurements that we'll be making. And before I start, I really want to acknowledge the efforts of collaborators that have formed sort of an EHT polarimetry working group. And a lot of people invested a huge amount of time in developing the calibration strategies and processing strategies that make this all work. So we've already seen this plot a few times. You know, it's the fall in correlated flux with increasing baseline, which immediately gives you a sort of characteristic angular size for the emission region. And the beauty of this is that you don't need any specific model of what the emission looks like. So it's quite robust. And it's telling us that we're resolving structure on these scales, and that, of course, is very exciting for polarization because it suggests that if we extend this to polarimetric VLBI, we'll be able to resolve polarized structures on the same scales. Now, the other half of the story is, of course, the spectrum. And the spectrum, as we've seen, is very special. It peaks at the submillimeter. And this is usually thought to be synchrotron radiation. It's, you know, typically said from a thermal distribution of electrons, but, you know, of course, the story is probably more complicated than that, as we've seen. But in any case, we're observing near the peak of this, so it's suggesting that we're transitioning to the region at least where it's becoming optically thin. So this also is good news for polarization. So I just want to motivate that, you know, with synchrotron radiation, polarization is really expected, and the polarization, if we can make images of it, is going to be tracing the magnetic fields. So if we can image the polarization, we can image the magnetic fields. And of course, as we've seen, magnetic fields are central to the physics of the innermost accretion flow. They're what mediate accretion through the MRI and allow the black hole to be, you know, accreting matter at all. And they're also probably very important in the formation and culmination of relativistic jets. And you know, interestingly, of course, they can even pierce the event horizon and allow these systems to extract rotational energy from the black hole. But I also want to emphasize, and you know, Jeff touched on this briefly, that Faraday rotation is also a very important diagnostic for us. It's going to tell us about the magnetic field strength of plasma density on much larger scales, and begin to allow us to place this tiny speck of emission near the black hole in a more global accretion context. And near the emission region, where the plasma is presumably highly relativistic, instead of Faraday rotation, you'll have Faraday conversion, where linear polarization is converted into circular polarization. And this provides us with yet another diagnostic of the local relativistic plasma to the emission region. So polarization is really going to allow us to extend our measurements and understand these systems in a much broader sense. Now, the polarization of SAGE star is quite special. It turns out linear polarization is not detected below about 100 gigahertz. And the data so far are fairly sparse, but even though there are only a few data points, it's already been incredibly informative. So even just the detection of linear polarization above 100 gigahertz was enough to completely rule out the original advection-dominated accretion flow models, which would require plasma densities and magnetic field strengths that are much too high given the Faraday rotation, for instance. Also, in the original models, the emission was self-absorbed at these frequencies, so it'd be unpolarized if the electron distribution was thermal. Now, more recently, it's been argued that the rotation measures may be too small for a jet. So I just really want to emphasize that only a few data points can really steer our theoretical understanding in a very powerful way. But the critical difference between what we can do and what these previous measurements have done is that all of these previous measurements were limited to sort of arc-second resolution or worse. And because polarization isn't detected below 100 gigahertz, you can't use facility instruments like VLBA to achieve the required angular resolution. So the EHT can really fill in an important role here. Now, the situation is quite different in near-infrared. Here, during flares, the polarization can shoot up and be 50%. And, of course, the critical difference here is that in near-infrared, you don't have some bright quiescent flux that might be diluting your polarization. But this is, of course, another very important part of the story, and we need to make sure that we can tie our measurements to the near-infrared and you know, begin to assemble a comprehensive picture of what's going on. The last thread of the story that I think is going to become increasingly important is simulations. And these have really come a long way in the last decade or so. So initially, it was just, you know, some magnetized Keplerian disk with ray tracing. And then, you know, Avery added the ability to incorporate a lot of physics and do these semi-analytic models. And more recently, there's been polarized radiative transfer of these 3D GRMHD simulations. And kind of generically across all of these, they tend to predict polarization fractions of 30 or 40% across the image. So the question is, why don't we see that? The answer has to do with the polarization itself. Polarization is a vector field. And so what that means is, because your connected element interferometry is only sensitive to the image average, because it doesn't resolve the emission region, if there are changes in the direction of the polarization, that will lead to cancellations. So I think that there are really four possibilities for the sort of 7% polarization that's seen. One is that maybe it's just a low intrinsic polarization. It could be optically thick, for instance, but if the electron distribution is non-thermal, you could easily achieve this polarization level. A second might be that maybe you have some sort of unassociated polarization component. Of course, in the early days, dust was a big concern. But in any case, there might be some weak unassociated component that's giving you this bit of polarization that you see. There could be disordered fields and a turbulent and chaotic flow. Or you might have large-scale ordered magnetic fields threading the regions near the event horizon. But there might be changes in direction throughout these regions so that the image average is still quite low. And you really need to resolve this emission region to discern which of these is correct. So just a word about polarimetry with VLBI. To get total flux, all you do is you correlate, say, right circular at one site with right circular at another, or left circular at one site with left circular at another. And it turns out that the polarization information is encoded in the crosshand correlations, correlating right circular at one site with left circular at another, and vice versa. Now, if you form this coherency matrix, you can then easily construct Stokes parameters. And what they're usually talked about in terms of linear polarization is a polarization fraction and a polarization direction, or EVPA. All of this is quite straightforward, actually. What we do is one additional trick, and this is to get around the issue that Vincent mentioned, and that's that you have some huge phase from the atmosphere that's varying on timescales of, 5 or 10 seconds. So what we do is we form a fractional polarization, a crosshand divided by a parallel hand. And when you do this, the only phase that matters is the differential phase, the differential atmospheric phase between left and right circular. And this tends to be pretty constant over a day or so. So this is very special. We're exploiting the fact that the atmosphere is not birefringent, but it allows us to construct effectively a closure quantity in this way. Then all we have to worry about is the fact that our instrument's not perfect. So there are terms called leakage terms, which introduce spurious linear polarization. And these can often dwarf the signal that you're interested in. However, the beautiful thing here is that leakage terms tend to be stable over sort of years or more. So if you can determine them using one bright calibration source, then it's easy to invert them on all of your data. But once we establish all of this, what you're left with is a baseline-based closure quantity. Closure phase is hard for us to interpret because it involves three different baselines. It's also hard for us because we have a very narrow triangle, so there's a huge cancellation in the long baselines. Here we have a much more direct observable that we can make sense of. And I just want to mention one other thing that's interesting, and that's that fractional polarization is actually immune to scatter broadening. You might worry that blurring from scattering might kill off all the small-scale polarization structure in your image. Turns out it has no effect whatsoever. And interestingly, Vincent didn't mention it, but closure phase is also immune to scatter broadening. So we've talked a lot about jets, and I understand jets are very attractive from a theoretical perspective. You can't hide everything behind the scattering. There's no reason, for instance, if you have asymmetric structure at 20 gigahertz or 40 gigahertz, where the scattering is huge, you would still see non-zero closure phases. We'll talk more about this later this week. Now, the hiccup here is that what we do is we measure now fractional polarization in the visibility domain. So we're taking the Fourier transform of Stokes Q plus IU over the Fourier transform of Stokes I. And the problem here is you're used to fractional polarization in the image domain, and these two things are not Fourier conjugate pairs. So all of our intuition, things like Parseval's theorem, that all breaks down. You can have some odd behavior. For instance, fractional polarization in the visibility domain can be greater than one. So interpretation requires a little bit of care, but I'll show in a moment that we can still learn quite a lot. So first, our calibration solution. Here it's shown the leakage terms at each site, and each site has two leakage terms, one for left and one for right circular. And we derived this leakage, this calibration solution using observations of many different sources. And the problem is that none of our sources has simple or known structure. So it's very hard to be sure that we know that we're deriving the correct solution. We have to make some assumptions. To give you a little confidence in this, you'll notice that there's a very distinctive symmetry between left and right D terms at different sites. It turns out that symmetry is very special. It'll arise anytime your observing system is unitary. That is to say, anytime it preserves orthogonal inputs and also preserves power. So this is a very common thing in instrumental systems. For instance, if your quarter wave plates are at a tuned frequency that's a little different than your observing frequency, or another would be if your quarter wave plates get shifted a little bit, they're not perfectly installed. These are all cases where you would see the symmetry. A second thing is that the participating connected element arrays can determine their own leakage terms. Not completely, but they can determine certain relationships between them. So the orange line here shows the average real part of the leakage terms that you would get using historical measurements from the SMA, from Dan Maroney's thesis. You can see that that measurement agrees very well with our inferred average part of the real part of the D terms at the SMA. So there are a lot of reasons that, you know, none of this information was imposed prior, so it's very reassuring that we see these types of effects. Now here's an example of some of our data. This is Bialak. And what I'm showing here is U and V are baseline, as Vincent defined. U is east-west and V is north-south. And at each point where you see a tick, that's where we have a measured value. The color indicates the magnitude of the polarization, and the direction of that tick mark indicates its EVPA, its angle. Now, one thing to notice immediately is that these observing tracks extend over many hours, but you see that there's just nice smooth variation. That's from intrinsic source structure. So, you know, as I said, the atmospheric phase varies over 5 or 10 seconds, and that's clearly been very effectively accounted for by forming these quotients. However, you know, BLAC has relatively low polarization. We see very smooth structure on the longest baselines, indicating that we're just beginning to resolve the polarized flux and all the structure that's there for BLAC. Now, for Sagittarius Star, the situation is quite different. On short baselines, from SMT to Karma, we see rather low polarization fractions, 5 to 7%, similar to those previous connected element observations. And you'll notice that there's a lot of sort of fluff along those observing tracks. That looks like noise, but it's not. That's actually intrinsic variability of the source over time. Now, when we go to the longest baselines, what we see is that the polarization fraction shoots up. It has these patches that can go as high as 70 or 80%. And one thing that I'm showing in this plot that I didn't intend last is I'm showing there are two ticks at each point, one for each of our observing bands, each is half a gigahertz. And you can see that these track each other very well. This is telling you that these high polarizations are not just some fluctuation from noise or something like that. They're actually extremely robust measurements. And this is after calibration, but even if we didn't calibrate at all, you know, we saw that's sort of a 5 to 10% effect. These are extremely secure measurements, and the only way to produce them is if you have large-scale ordered magnetic fields near the black hole. Okay, so it's telling us that the coherence length of these magnetic fields has to be something like a few Schwarzschild radii. One more thing that I'd like to point out is you'll notice that there's a distinctive asymmetry here. And this is especially confusing for those of us who do VLBI, because in images of flux, if you were to make the same plot, you never have an asymmetry like this. There's a conjugation symmetry. It turns out the only reason you can have this is because the polarization image is a vector field. And so actually, to produce this asymmetry requires changes in direction of the polarization throughout the emission region. If it was a uniform direction throughout the emission region, you would never be able to reproduce this, no matter how you change its amplitude across the image. The second thing we can do is we can go back to our short baselines. And these are also quite special. It turns out that on short baseline, the leading order change in EVPA comes from the offset between the centroid of the total flux and the centroid of the polarized flux. Okay, so if those are offset, then as you increase your baseline, you'll see that your polarization vector just rotates linearly. So it introduces this phase gradient. And the thing that's so remarkable is that even on your shortest baseline, which has a nominal resolution of something like 300 microarcseconds, a microarcsecond of offset would lead to a degree change in EVPA. This is a very sensitive way to probe offsets, just as Vincent alluded to. And I'd like to make an analogy with that point earlier that's, you know, we're all used to this idea that if the flux falls, we get a characteristic size for the emission region. And I'd like to motivate that if you see this rotation of EVPA with baseline, that's really providing you with a characteristic displacement between the polarized and the total flux. And so we can do this in a way that doesn't require any modeling or any assumptions about the image. So now we can try this for our data. And on the top here, there are 3 points at each time. 2 are the SMT karma measurements. And there are those 2 hemispheres. One is right-left, and one is left-right. The third, the black points, is the data from the karma array. Now, the karma array doesn't resolve the source at all, and its baseline doesn't change in time, which means that those variations you see of the black points are all intrinsic variability of the source. Okay, and the fact that the variations from the SMT karma are tracing them so nicely is allowing us to unambiguously associate this variability with dynamical activity near the black hole. One other thing is that, you know, we didn't impose that these would agree throughout our calibration solution. So this is also actually a very nice demonstration that our calibration is reliable. Now, if you take the difference between those 2 measurements, SMT karma, that's shown on the bottom. And on the right, you can see the inferred offset. So on the first 2 days, when Sagittarius is relatively quiescent, that inferred offset has a median value of something like 5 microarc seconds, about a gravitational radius. And again, you know, this is pretty remarkable given that this is our shortest baseline. However, on the last day, the situation is quite different. Here, there's much more polarization variability, and also it appears that the offsets are much larger. They can be between 50 and 100 microarc seconds, which are more like the scales of the lens disco. So again, this is really pointing towards, you know, dynamical activity right in those innermost regions. Now, I just want to point out 2 things. The first is that we see here, it's apparent that this phase information is giving us super resolution. It's especially robust on the short baselines. I think these baselines are really important for the EHT. And second is that we're naturally getting time resolution here, just whatever the cadence of our scans is. There's no model that's gone into this. And yet we're able to talk about offsets that are dynamical, and we could easily do this on minute timescales with coming data. So this is just a preview of the rich information on time variability that the EHT is going to have. Now, I just want to emphasize that I think we're really just scratching the surface here. On this last day that's the most dynamical, this is what the polarization looks like in the complex plane. And you see it traces out this beautiful loop. And, you know, a similar thing has been reported by Dan Moroni back in 2007. And we see this type of activity regularly in our data. If you were to look at flux in our data, it's just sitting still. You don't see any changes at all. So the polarization is really uncovering a rich source of time variability, and it's going to be a great thing for future study, especially when we add southern sites that allow us longer tracks. You know, maybe we can see multiple orbits if that's really what's going on. And also, of course, the addition of more baselines. So we have this picture of ordered magnetic fields near the event horizon. I think there are really 3 scenarios that are compatible with this. The first would be shear fields, you know, a Keplerian flow or something like that. A second would be some sort of magnetically dominant state. And I think, you know, the most popular example of this is something like a magnetically arrested disk. And the third would be maybe ordered magnetic fields, colloidal fields in a jet launching region. But I just want to emphasize here that the close alignment between the total and the polarized flux makes it extremely difficult to have multi-component emission models. That will cause huge offsets between polarized and total flux. So what it's telling us is that if there is a jet, it's going to be very difficult to light up both the jet and the disk and be compatible with these measurements. Likewise, it's very difficult to have a bipolar jet be compatible with these measurements. So again, I think this is just a preview of much richer information to come, but already I think this can be an important way to guide our understanding and hopefully make the connection with simulations. Just as a preview, I'm sure you'll see many images, probably in the next talk, of sample image reconstructions with the EHT. And I just want to point out that we can also do polarimetric image reconstructions using EHT data. So on the left is the simulated image from Jason Dexter. And on the right is a reconstructed image by Andrew Shale, a Harvard grad student, where he's taken that image and he's generated synthetic EHT data using expected baseline sensitivity. And you can see that it really looks like we'll be sensitive to the field morphology and small scale structures there. This is early stages of work, but it looks very promising. So in summary, you know, polarization with EHT is now just yielding its first results, but I think the calibration and data processing strategies are becoming mature. For Sagittarius, the high polarizations we see require ordered magnetic fields near the event horizon, telling us the emission has to be optically thin, it has to be synchrotron, and it's also telling us the polarized emission has to be very closely aligned with the total emission. Multi-component models are strongly disfavored, as Vincent's closure phase results also indicate. The other part of it is variability is a key part of the story, and it's going to become increasingly important as we move forward. And I just want to end with the important fact that, you know, imaging is not required to study variability. Already, we can see that we can recover precise information on the shortest timescales that we can sample. So I think the future is bright. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. We have time for a question or two.
So you showed a very interesting variation in EVPA in the day 86, 2013.
Yeah.
So in 2013 data, do you see any? Any other evidence of the variation, for example, in closure phase or the amplitude data in day 86?
The amplitude data is an ongoing project that we're hoping to fold into this, but the calibration still needs work. The closure phase doesn't have the sensitivity to match this currently. One way to think of it is your closure phases are actually downgraded by the length of your short baseline. That's killing off because you have this narrow triangle where most of the signal's getting canceled. So despite the fact that the measurements are much higher signal to noise, the resulting closure phases are small, it's hard to make sense of that. So I would say it doesn't look like we can use many other angles to make this into a complete story yet. Unfortunately.
You showed some models by Dexter and others. What's been assumed about the Faraday screen?
Okay,
in those models about structure, time dependence, and the Faraday.
Yeah, the Faraday screen is definitely an important part of the story, and one I have ignored entirely. The Faraday rotation at 1.3 millimeters, on average, leads to something like 60 degrees of rotation. So it's important, but there doesn't seem to be much time variability of that. And you know, it does seem that it's occurring externally, right? Most of the Faraday rotation has to occur externally if the plasma is relativistic. So it's hard to imagine it imprinting a lot of small-scale structure on the images, and certainly it's not going to be leading to these, you know, minute timescale variations that we see. So I think it'll be important for reconstructing these large-scale images, but it's a little hard to say without, you know, of course, hopefully we'll have dual sideband observing and make images of the Faraday rotation, but I'm afraid I don't have much more than speculation right now.
Yeah. All right, let's thank Michael again.